The Rebel Capitalist Show, episode 213.
Welcome to the podcast that helps you build wealth and thrive in a world of out-of-control central banks and big governments. This is the Rebel Capitalist Show.
All right, guys, it gives me a great deal of pleasure to welcome someone back to the Rebel Capitalist Show. He is one of my favorites, always on CNBC. His name is Peter Bukvar. Peter, welcome back to the show.
Thanks, George, for having me.
Awesome. Now, I heard an interview that you did the other day with another one of my favorite media outlets. Well, I don't like CNBC that much. I like Real Vision way better. And you were talking to Ed Harrison, who's great. And you were going over a concept of the market calling the Fed's bluff, in the sense that the Fed is saying we're going to let inflation run hot, and the market, the bond market, is saying, nah, I don't think so. So can you go into that concept that you discussed with Ed?
Sure. Well, the premise being that considering that post-financial crisis with zero rates, negative rates, and QE, even though we know the Bank of Japan sort of initiated that playbook in years prior, but call that the modern era of central banking. And all these central banks that have done this type of policy have been able to get away with it because the inflation numbers have been low as measured. So it sort of gave them license to just keep on going, and they can lower rates. And if low rates aren't good enough, let's lower rates more. And if lower rates aren't good enough, let's lower rates more. And if our balance sheet's not big enough, let's just enlarge it more. And if that doesn't work, let's enlarge it more. So that's all fine and good for them as long as inflation remains low. But once that begins to change, once the markets actually begin to sniff out a scenario that maybe we are actually beginning to see the early signs of the central bankers getting the inflation that they want, well, I don't want to be a fixed income investor that's going to live through that time period. Right. So unlike 2013, when we had the taper tantrum, that was Fed driven. The Fed said, we're going to stop QE, and the market responded. This time around, the Fed gave no single signals whatsoever about a change in policy.
Well, they're still doing $120 billion a month, aren't they?
That, and they said that they're not raising rates until 2024.
Right.
But the market started to worry about rising inflation pressures. And we've seen that in the goods side, transportation costs, commodity prices. Now we're seeing it spill over into services. And that's why we've seen a rather dramatic rise in inflation expectations in the TIPS market. And a bond market that, outside of the Fed's manipulation on the short end, saying, you know what, we're going our own way.
Right.
And that you may not want to raise rates for years. You may still want to do your QE every month, but we're worried about the inflation story changing, and we are going to adjust rates for you. Mm. And that's what we've seen. And it's been a global phenomenon. Now, less so in Japan because they have the yield curve control, less so in Europe because the amount of QE so overwhelms the amount of net issuance. But in Australia and the US, where the QE is a smaller portion of the net issuance, they've lost control in the long end relative to where they want rates to be.
Yeah. And what's also interesting too, our good friend Lynn Alden has pointed out many times that the M2 money supply in the US went up by 25%. Compared to Japan, as an example, by 10% in 2020. So that would make sense why the rates are going up even more at the long end of the curve, maybe some more inflation expectations when you have the amount of currency units increasing by 25%. I know 10% is a lot, but it's there's a 15% delta there.
Right. And also, down on the ground level of real life inflation pressures. I mentioned commodity prices and also on the good side, but transportation as well. And supply chains have been turned upside down in COVID, and they are not easily repaired and fixed. And now we're seeing a shortage of semiconductors, and then auto industry plants are having to shut down because they can't get their semis. Every single company that makes something that then gets transported is feeling big inflationary pressures. The question is to what extent does it spill over into other areas of services outside of transportation, particularly rents, since rents make up a big chunk of CPI and less so on PCE in terms of bringing together both goods and services inflation. Because for years pre-COVID, services inflation was pretty persistent, running within CPI 3% per year. A lot of that medical care costs and rents. And there's always been this downward pressure on goods, which there typically always is, as technological advancements bring more production efficiency, you lower the price of producing products, and you get this goods deflation. Now you have goods inflation. You've seen a slowdown in services inflation because of COVID and rents. But now I think you're going to start to see an inflection higher in rents because of the dramatic increase we've seen in home prices. So CPI is not measuring home prices,
right,
but owner's equivalent rent will at some point follow the rise in home prices, as it has for the last 15 years. The change in home prices has led owner's equivalent rent. So now you have 10% increases in home prices, you're going to start to see an inflection higher owner's equivalent rent. If goods prices still remain sticky because supply chains are not repaired and so on and so on, and commodity prices still remain elevated, which I think they will and will go higher, then you have a combination of services and goods inflation that I think at least the TIPS market's beginning to sniff out.
Right.
I think that's going to mug these central bankers with that reality.
So a couple questions there. Where do you see the official CPI print in, let's say, a year? I think it just came out the other day. It was like 1.7. Do you see it getting up to 3 or 4, or how high? And then the other question would be, how does that affect the long end of the curve? And at what point does the long end of the curve really start to affect not only the stock market, but the real economy?
Well, just through easy comparisons in the next couple of months, it'll get into the twos. The question is what happens when those easy comparisons sort of go away? That we won't know until really June, July, August. But I think June, July, August, you're going to be seeing 3/10 month over month, and that you're going to see, even after the easy comparisons, potentially 3% inflation numbers. But within PCE, which is the other metric that the Fed likes to focus on more, even if it goes to 2.5, 2.6, you're talking 20 to 30 year highs in that PCE figure. So even though these aren't high rates of inflation, they're higher rates of inflation in the context of interest rates that are still low. Now, to the question of what level of rates matters for the market, well, it's clearly mattered for technology. We had a 10% correction in the NASDAQ that was solely attributed to the rise in interest rates. So we've already crossed that line. It's a question of whether the market gets accustomed to the new level of rates and we sort of consolidate here, which is possible, but rates are still going higher. And I always like to say that valuations don't matter until they do. It's very easy. If you're going to pay 25 times earnings for something, well, why not pay 30 or 35 or 40 times if interest rates are very low? Valuations don't matter on the upside. But when interest rate regime changes, when rates go up to a certain point, well, then valuations begin to matter and investors become more discriminating. Now, on the flip side, with value and commodity stocks will go where the commodity prices go. Value stocks that are trading at 10, 12 earnings, 10 to 12 times earnings, well, you get a rise in rates, well, what are you going to knock it really down? It's already so low already. But if that company is all of a sudden going to benefit from an improving economy, then investors won't care about a cheap valuation and won't penalize it as they would for a stock trading at 30 times, 40 times earnings, or let alone sales, which we've obviously seen with companies paying that kind of premium. And then you throw in the frothy areas of the market like SPACs. Well, a change in interest rates changes investor attitudes towards a variety of risk-taking and valuation. So it's more than just one sector of tech that could be impacted by this rise in rates, which I think will likely continue. Now, we've come a long way fast, and we've gotten very oversold in bonds, so I wouldn't be surprised if this 160 is probably the upper end, even though we are slightly above it today. But I think the rise in rates will surprise people on the upside. And then the question gets asked, well, how do central banks deal with it? And we've seen a few different responses. We've seen the Reserve Bank of Australia, which has decided to fight this through increasing QE. Now, they're already doing yield curve control. and this should be a lesson to all of the people that throw out yield curve control as a possible answer here. Yield curve control has failed in Australia. They went their yield curve control out to 3 years is 0.1%. 0.1, that's it. But you know where the 5-year Australian yield is? 0.85. Over the last couple months. Where's their 10-year? 170, got as high as 190. That's with yield curve control. How's yield curve control worked in Japan? Now they've gone out 10 years. Yeah, they've been able to maintain the 10-year yield within a pretty tight band of 20 basis points above and beyond zero. But what's the result? Well, they basically killed off their entire regional banking system.
Right.
So yield curve control is a very dangerous way to go. Now, I know people are going to say, well, the U.S. did it in the 40s and 50s. Right. And well, yeah, I maybe they'll try, but it was a difficult inflationary situation, and we saw a big spike in interest rates after they got out of it. So it's not necessarily the right way to go. Then you have the ECB. So here, well, first of all, here you have central bankers that want higher inflation.
Right.
Well, usually when you get higher inflation, you get higher interest rates. Well, now that they're getting the higher interest rates, now they are losing their mind. Then I ask, well, why are you rooting for higher inflation then? So the ECB has decided to fight back. Yesterday they announced they're not changing the overall total package in euros of QE, but they're changing, they're speeding it up in order to suppress and tamp down this recent rise in rates. So the German 10-year is still negative, but because it's less negative, the ECB is in a tizzy here. So it's really just, it's really in insanity. But that's what they chose to do. And then, you know, we'll see what Powell says next week. I mean, the early commentary from central bankers within the Fed, they've sort of welcomed this rise in long rates because they're saying, well, it means that the market's sniffing out a better economy. But at some point, they will likely respond, even though they also want higher inflation. Well, if you're going to want higher inflation, you got to accept higher interest rates. But they won't respond really until something breaks. And
I mean, they just want negative real rates. That's the whole thing, isn't it?
Right. That's what all central bankers love. And but the Fed's not going to really do anything in terms of altering their QE program or Operation Twist or even yield curve control until things break. And when I say break, I'm talking about credit markets that get unhinged, spreads that widen out, stock market that falls sharply, housing that maybe gets impacted. We're not there yet. So I think that they're going to be somewhat nonchalant next week, and maybe, I don't want to say dismissive, but I think that they're going to hope that things calm down, rather than take the stance of the other central bankers and try to fight the market. Because if you fight the market, you will likely lose unless you want to be the Bank of Japan and basically own the JGB market. I don't think the Fed wants to be put into that position.
Yeah, you know what's interesting too is when you talk about they're going to just kind of sit back and wait until they see something break, it's a lot easier to see something break in the financial economy than it is the real economy, because the stock market goes down by 10% in a day and you're like, oh, it's broken. But you know, with housing prices as an example, that's such a slow moving machine. That could be broken for a long, long time before it just shows up in the data that could go to the Fed. But the question I have is, do you think we've turned the corner? And I mean, we've been in a, let's call it a bond bull market since 1981. I mean, that's what, 40 years or so of interest rates going down. Do you think we've turned that corner and we're going into a bond bear market for the next 40 years?
Well, I think we have definitely turned the corner. You had a 100-year pandemic and a collapse in global interest rates, and I think you can mark that collapse as the bottom. I don't believe the Fed is going to negative interest rates. So if you're not going to negative interest rates on the short end, I think there's no chance on any other part of the curve you're going to go negative. And if you didn't break below, call it 50 basis points in the 10-year, in the middle of a pandemic, with the Fed doing massive QE, slashing rates back to zero, then you ain't going back there. And it's just a question of where rates go on the upside, how much the Fed tries to fight it, and is it a methodical move higher in interest rates? Is it a point where interest rates really can't rise much more because things really start to break. And when you think about all the debt that we have out there, I don't necessarily know the answers to all these questions, except I'm pretty confident that the 2020 lows in yields across the world, you will not see those yields again.
Yeah, that's really interesting.
For our lifetimes.
Yeah. So it's just trying to think through the knock-on effects over the next even 10 or 20 years of interest rates just gradually going higher and higher and higher, and what that does to the economy. I guess it really all depends on the inflation for the economy and a lot of different cross currents there that were kind of unknowable right now.
For sure. And there's no question that if rates break to a certain level, that things start to get negatively impacted. And I don't know what that level is, 1.75, 2.5, who knows? But the Fed will fight it, and they will try to contain it, because when you have the debt levels that we have, you have the budget deficits that we need to finance.
Yeah,
right. Things start to turn messy if rates get to a certain level. So,
I mean, they've got to at least try to peg the short end, because the government has so much short-term debt that if they're trying to roll over, call it $10 trillion a year, I mean, at those rates that they're paying, I think they pay an average like 1.5% or 2% right now. If that average goes up to 4 or 5%, they've got real problems.
Well, they're essentially doing the yield curve control verbally by telling us that we're not raising the Fed funds rate to 2024. And if they stick to that and they keep repeating it, that's essentially yield curve control out to a couple of years. And QE has been averaging out to call it 5 or 6 years. And that wasn't enough to stop the five-year yield from spiking. So the market's bigger than the Fed right now because of the amount of supply we're seeing. And there's danger in the Fed getting too big. There's danger in having too many reserves and how that's going to affect banks and their desire and ability to lend. I mean, there are a lot of logistical problems the bigger the Fed's balance sheet gets. But I'm sure that won't stop them from fighting this. But then it all gets back to, well, if you're bothered by higher interest rates, then why do you keep shooting for higher inflation?
Yeah. I was saying that like a year ago. I said it's so ironic that the Fed, it's like Superman trying to create kryptonite in the sense that they're trying.
You're creating, you know, what's going to kill you.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. So M2 money supply went up. And I don't know if you're a fan. I know I talk to Snyder all the time, and Snyder just completely dismisses M2 money supply. So I don't know if you think it's an accurate measurement, but if it is, M2 went up by 25% in 2020, let's say. And the reason I bring that up is because I went through that tweet storm that Michael Burry had the other day. I think he's deleted all the tweets. I don't know if you saw that, but he referenced a book called Dying of Money. And I found it fascinating. So I went and grabbed the book and I've been reading it, but they articulate beautifully what happened during the Weimar Germany hyperinflation. And they point out that, yeah, okay, when everyone was, you know, going around in a wheelbarrow full of cash, that was really only about a 1 year period, call it 1923. But the seeds were sown for this far in advance. So starting in 1914, when they had to create all this additional currency to fight the war. So they gave the specific numbers. So as an example, 1914 to 1918, CPI, or their version of it, was going up at about 10 to 15% per year. So compounded over that time frame, prices basically doubled, while the money supply increased nine times. So that's about 50-60% per year. And that's when the seeds were really sown, because once they get past a point, it's kind of, you're at a point of no return. And it sounds ridiculous and it sounds insane, but then you think about 2020 and you're like, well, wait a minute here. If their seeds were being sown when their money supply was increasing by 50%, let's say, we're at 25% already. So, I mean, do you see the M2 money supply being increased that dramatically moving forward, or do you think 2020 was kind of one-off deal?
Well, I think that pace is certainly one-off, because you also have to think that, you know, M2 is measuring deposits. It's measuring corporate deposits and individual deposits. And look how much money how many billions the federal government put in to deposits between the PPP loans to individuals through the checks, the extended benefits. So all this trillions of dollars that went into deposits, and that was reflected in that money supply year over year growth rate. So that should moderate. But you know, a guy like Schneider, who I see him on Twitter. I've never spoken to the guy. They talk about the velocity, how all this money, as long as there's no velocity, and velocity keeps shrinking, then it's not inflationary. It's not going to show up, you know, and so on and so on. So that's the question is what happens with velocity, particularly this year as you get into the summer and the vaccine gets further rolled out and the economy rebounds and businesses are going to be looking for loans again. And we can see how generous or still restrictive banks will be. So it's all this stuff is we have to see how this plays out. But
yeah,
we acknowledge that things have changed, that this is, I think, a new interest rate regime, a new inflation regime, because you're combining both fiscal and monetary policy at its extreme, in addition to, you know, I mentioned the dearth of supply in commodities and supply chains that have been turned upside down, and that you've probably seen, you know, at least a short term bottom. Now, I'm a believer long term. I think there's good deflation and bad deflation. Long term, technology and efficiency leads to good long term deflation.
Yeah.
And it's typically inflationary periods are usually just cyclical time frames, not a secular time frame, I believe, at least on the good side. Services are different, particularly in the US. We've had secular increase in services inflation. Just compare the cost of a concert ticket today than when we were younger and we went to a concert, and when we were paying $20 a ticket, and now a concert ticket's $250.
Yeah,
that's service inflation. But I think we're in the middle and the beginnings of a bout of cyclical inflation.
Well, let's push back, Peter, and say, okay, we think velocity is going to go down. It's going to continue to go down. The stimulus checks are kind of a temporary thing. We're going to get political gridlocks. So they're not going to do a Green New Deal. This is going to be the last stimulus round, and it's not going to be enough to change consumer behavior. And everyone's kind of hoarding money right now. All these businesses are going to go bankrupt. The unemployment rate is, the stated rate is artificially low. So you're going to have future bankruptcies. That's going to decrease velocity more. It's going to bring down even, let's say, nominal GDP. There's nothing the government can do about it. The debts are so high. So this is going to create deflation at least over the next 2 or 3 years and bring interest rates back down. This is just a one-off. So why is that wrong?
Well, 2022, we'll see. We'll see what kind of fiscal cliff effects we have. Government spending all this money, and you almost need to keep spending all that money to maintain things, and you could have a hangover in 2022. But at least looking out the next couple of quarters, the vaccine is going to resuscitate the global economy.
Okay.
I just don't see how it's not. I mean, people are going back and things are reopening, and that is going to resuscitate things, and it's happening, and it's just going to continue. So the economy is going to do great through the rest of the year. It's just how sustainable that is, again, with all this stimulus that's being pumped into the global economy, and what kind of hangovers do we have, and what the sort of negative effects of higher rates, what will that have? Because if rates start to tick up, you know, that creates its own speed bump, because we are so, because we don't have economic cycles anymore. We have credit cycles.
Yeah.
We have credit cycles that are driven by central bank policy, whereas there used to be a time where we had an economy built on savings and investment, and when inventories would get too high, we'd have a recession, and then inventories would get so too low, we would have an expansion. Now we have credit cycles that juice asset prices and ebb and flow with the direction of interest rates. So if now the Fed can maintain their easy stance, but if longer term rates go up, and that starts to negatively affect the credit cycle, then that will negatively affect the economy. So I think we're going to have a big economic rebound. But if it gets to a point where it starts to lead to higher interest rates, that can then sow the seeds for the next decline in the economy.
Right.
That makes sense.
This podcast is brought to you by Rebel Capitalist Pro, the best online investing research. I have teamed up with Chris McIntosh and Lynn Alden, two of the best in the business, to create Rebel Capitalist Pro and give you the tools you need to build wealth and thrive in this crazy world of economic insanity. Rebel Capitalist Pro is jam-packed with Chris and Lynn's incredible research. We have live stream Q&As where you can ask your questions directly to Chris, Lynn, and myself. And the best of all, there's an online member forum which allows you to network, learn, and explore ideas with like-minded individuals. What are you waiting for? Check out Rebel Capitalist Pro right now at georgegammon.com/pro. That's georgegammon.com/pro. Take action today and do something your future self will thank you for.
I did a video the other day, and I went on to the Bureau of Economic Analysis website for the government, and they did this study. It was actually state by state, but then they took a total, and they measured the average income. And from in 2020, from Q1 to Q2, the average income went up by over 30%. Over 30%, while you have the unemployment rate going up to, call it 20%. And so if there's 20% fewer people working, there's 20% fewer goods and services being created, while at the same time, income's going up by 30%. And oh, by the way, expenses are going down dramatically, because we've got a rent moratorium or a mortgage moratorium and a rent forbearance or whatever it was. You know, people don't have to pay their housing costs. Right. So that's, you know, you have all that, let's say, I don't know if I want to call it pent up demand, because I agree with the argument that you can only go to so many steak dinners, you know, once you get things back to normal. But you've got a lot of purchasing power that's just sitting there, while you've got all these supply chain shocks and disruptions and fewer goods and services and people being less incentivized to actually go back to work. So there's just some incredible cross currents at play when you juxtapose that to all these businesses being out of business and how that affects supply or demand moving forward. You know, I think what it boils down to is it's almost like it's more of a political question now than it is an economic question, because it all depends on how much the government, how much fiscal are we going to get. It's, we've gone from kind of monetary policy to fiscal policy driving things. So, you know, the politicians are at the wheel. And so if they're going to pump out $5 trillion per year, then it's a completely different landscape than if they just turn the taps off right now.
Well, we started the conversation, I talked about how low inflation gives central bankers the feeling of license to do what they want.
Yeah.
The next test is, well, how does this influence the fiscal decisions going forward? Because even the administration have been asked, well, isn't all the spending going to lead to higher rates and higher inflation? And they'll say, oh, it's better to do more now than we'll deal with the aftermath after. Mm. Well, if rates continue to go up, that later is now going to be here. If inflation starts to kick in, that later is now here. So it won't be so easy for them to just go spend another few trillion dollars on this and that if the cost of funding it starts to go up. Now, that will then lead to them saying, okay, we need to raise taxes, we need to pay for this, and that creates its own economic challenges. But it'll be the bond market that not just takes away the powers of central bankers, it could take away the powers of the fiscal side of those who want to just spend our way to prosperity.
Yeah. Think of the 1970s. I mean, what would happen if they tried to do their version of a $2 trillion stimulus package in 1979 or something like that? I mean, who knows what would have happened to inflation? Who knows what would have happened to interest rates? That's kind of a thought experiment that you kind of go through and you're like, that may be applicable.
I think a big part of the inflation conversation, as you look at the 70s inflation, a lot of that was also wage pressure inflation. And, you know, it's very easy for people to say now, well, we have this big output gap. We still have 10 million people out of work. There's no chance we're going to get wage pressures. But we have to understand that one of the things that we saw post Great Recession was a big decline in the participation rate. So the question is what sort of labor market damage was done this time around, and that maybe you're going to still have a lot of people that are now getting paid to not work to a level that exceeds their prior income.
Right, right.
People that are just going to be stuck not looking for work because they're going to be benefiting from government transfer payments, and that the supply of labor, even with an output gap, even with still a lot of people not in the labor force, that supply may not be enough to meet demand. I mean, we saw yesterday January job openings almost getting back to 7 million. We're almost getting back to pre-pandemic levels in terms of the demand for labor. The problem is the supply. And as the year progresses and as the economic numbers will look better, are we going to see some wage pressures because of the demand is going to exceed the supply of labor? And that how much is a restaurant going to have to pay to bring back their full staff?
Right, right. How are
you competing against an added $300 a week of unemployment benefits that people are going to receive through September? Well, it's going to cost me more to bring back this labor. And yeah, we can say, well, people don't want to just collect unemployment benefits, but there are plenty of people that do. Some people will of course, honor work more than play and will take that job, even though they may make less. But you're going to see, I believe, higher wage pressure relative to an unemployment rate that people are used to. And that pre-COVID, you had a 3.5% unemployment rate that only started to begin to see higher wages. I think you'll see a higher unemployment rate that leads to that because that supply part of the labor market, you thought a participation rate was low pre-COVID. I think it's going to remain low post-COVID.
Yeah, that's interesting. What do you think about UBI? Is that something you think we'll see in the future?
Well, we already have it.
But, I mean permanent. Explicit.
Go back to the 1960s. I mean, welfare is a form of UBI.
Right, right.
The question is what requirements do you have to get somebody off it? Or UBI is technically welfare without any requirements.
Yeah, what everyone gets it. Yeah.
Right. We're just everyone gets it and you don't have to give a reason why. You just get it. So it's basically just welfare without strings attached.
Yeah, exactly. So do you think that's something we might see in the future? The welfare without strings
attached? There. We have, you know, these earned income tax credits and now we have unearned income tax credits now in this package and they're keep raising the bar. And yeah, we essentially have a form of it because now, again, we have now unearned income tax credits for people that don't even pay income taxes.
Right. What do you think about a wealth tax moving forward?
Well, I'm a bleeding heart libertarian. So when I hear that, my head explodes.
Well,
in the Constitution and private property. So
what do you think the probabilities are that we get that? The reason I say that, Peter, is because I've tried to give it a lot of thought, and I just think that we're moving into an economy that's so reliant upon asset prices to the point where the political narrative is going to be more focused on taxing wealth and less focused on taxing income because of that economic shift. And I'm not saying that income taxes are going down. I'm definitely not saying that. I'm just talking about the emphasis now being more on taxing wealth because, you know, in California, they've even discussed an unrealized capital gains tax. In Canada, they were discussing an excess profits tax. So at what point do we say, all right, well, all these people that own assets, houses, shares of XYZ company, they're getting way, way, way ahead, while the person who doesn't own assets is just getting further behind. That's not fair. So we need to come up with an excess, call it capital gains tax. We need to have an excess, you name it, tax, but more going back to that wealth tax that Elizabeth Warren has been referencing, which as a fellow libertarian, my concern is, yeah, it starts at, let's call it 0.4% for people making over 50 million. But in 5 years, now all of a sudden, it's down at 5% for everyone making above 100,000.
Well, I want to believe that it would be considered unconstitutional. Yeah. And I have to believe that you would need 60 votes in the Senate to pass something like this. And there's probably zero chance that happens. So I would say from a rhetoric standpoint, I'm sure we'll hear more from Bernie and Elizabeth on this stuff, and others will chime in as well, and the squad and so on. But in terms of brass knuckles, constitutionality of it, I think it would not pass. And legislatively, I think it would have very little chance of passing.
Great. I'm glad I asked. That makes me feel a lot better. All right. You know, another thing I wanted to get your thoughts on, because when we were talking about the M2 money supply increasing, and I've really tried to encourage my viewers and listeners to try to get hyper-focused on the deposits or the liabilities of the commercial banking system, because everyone gets focused on the Fed, quote unquote, printing money and doing all these things. It's sometimes it's hard for that to transfer over unless there's government spending. But one way, to the old school way, to increase the money supply was through the commercial banking system. They created the money by creating additional loans. So my point there is, if we're seeing M2 skyrocket as a result of the things we discussed earlier, but we see the yield curve steepening, the way I understand it, that's going to incentivize banks to create additional loans. So could we get into an environment where the yield curve is steepening, the commercial banking system starts kind of licking their chops and saying, hey, here's an opportunity. Let's start lending more, therefore creating more currency units through the lending process, while at the same time, the government maybe is doing more stimulus, where we see the M2 really go up again. Do you think that's a possibility, or am I not thinking that through correctly?
Well, no, it's a definite possibility, but keep in mind that a lot of banks loan LIBOR plus, and call it 3-month LIBOR is still basically pinned near zero because of the Fed funds rate. So regardless of where the 10-year goes, many banks, small, medium-sized banks in particular, are lending LIBOR plus. There's only so much spread that they can attain, even with the rise in the long end. Now, there's certainly plenty of fixed rate lending and longer term lending and not necessarily, as I mentioned, floating rate lending, because essentially that's what LIBOR plus is. So yeah, there'll be definite yield to capture that banks would want to take advantage of. But one thing we've seen, one thing we'll see is whether banks have been big buyers of treasuries. You know, they're paying out almost nothing on deposits. They can buy a 2-year note. I'm just looking at my screen at, where I should say a 5-year, and get 85 basis points, pay out 0.1 to depositors, and just sit for 5 years and lock in that spread. So banks should be in the business of lending to businesses, but banks have all of a sudden turned into a financing vehicle for the U.S. government because banks have increased their ownership of treasuries and agency paper by $800 billion over the past year. And we'll see what happens with that depending on how the Fed rules on the supplementary leverage ratio and whether they extend the waiver or not. But I do think on paper, you would think that an improving economy, a steeper yield curve, that banks would be more amenable to lending to small, medium-sized businesses. Because I know from experience with respect to small businesses is that lending standards are still very tight for banks. And I hope they loosen up for a lot of small businesses. And maybe they do if the yield curve steepens and they have some incentive to lend out financially. Yeah.
We'll see. Definitely an interesting cross current to pay attention to. So I know through listening to you on Real Vision and whatnot, you're a bull on commodities. But I kind of like to get your opinion on the next maybe year, then the next 5 years on the commodity cycle, just because a lot of things are getting, I don't want to call them expensive, but they've gone up a lot in price, such as copper. So kind of where do you see commodities now for the next year, then maybe the next 5 years?
Well, it's interesting. So when you take agriculture, for example, the easy thing about looking at agricultural commodities is that the demand for food is pretty steady. Mm-hmm. As long as the world's population grows, you can basically draw out where the demand for food is going to be. So really calling agriculture is trying to figure out what the supply side is. How many acres are being planted? Corn, soybean, wheat, so on. What's the weather going to be like? That's more difficult to figure out. So while I'm bullish on agriculture, I acknowledge that it's hard to predict agricultural prices past sort of the next planting season. Again, I know the demand side is pretty linear going higher, but the supply side, season to season is more difficult. I do think, though, when you think about the sprawl of the world in terms of population growth that has eaten into, no pun intended, arable land, that you have less acres being allocated to farming, but on the flip side, you have more productive farms. So I do think that with all that said, agricultural prices will continue to go higher, but not necessarily to the same extent as others. You mentioned copper. Copper is probably the most important commodity in the world right now in terms of its usage, particularly with electric vehicles, which is obviously the rage. You need 4 to 5 times more copper in that vehicle than an internal combustion engine vehicle.
Right.
So just by that shift, you need more copper, and solar panels and even wind turbines, you need copper. And copper is just very important. And I haven't seen any copper SPACs lately. So the level of investment in copper mines over the last bunch of years that we've seen in EVs. So yeah, you want EVs, but you still need to get a lot of copper in order to create those EVs. So that's the problem with copper is if you had years of underinvestment in a lot of mines, and now you have this inflection higher in demand. I think with energy, oil prices, every CEO of an oil company is getting whacked in the head with ESG and fossil fuels getting a bad rap. And what energy CEO is going to really ramp up capital investment over the next couple of years? They're just not. They're going to run their business for cash. It's going to be like tobacco companies where they know that they're just going to get eaten away every year. Now, at least for crude oil, there's still going to be demand growing over the next 10 years. But you think about, they see the EV trend and again, this whole clean energy trend, and they're just not going to invest aggressively, which means that there's going to be limited supply, which means at least in the next couple of years, it's going to be higher prices for energy. And then you get into other industrial metals like nickel, and that's going to, a demand driver for this new energy age. And so I think that the demand side is not going to be met by enough supply, and we're going to get higher prices in the next couple of years. Yeah. But again, they're still commodities. They still trade in a cycle. And at some point, supply will meet demand and these prices will go back down again and you want to be out of the trade. But I think right now we're still in the upward side part of that cycle.
Yeah, and I'd like to point out too that the best performing industry since the mid-1990s, I believe, has been tobacco when you reinvest the dividends. So maybe something to be said for those oil producers. I don't know.
Yeah, because they've been able to offset the volume declines through price increases.
Yeah. Because there were so many regulations that it prevented anyone from competing with the tobacco companies that were already in existence. So,
right. And now the tobacco companies are shifting into, you know, other technologies that's trying to wean people off a combustible cigarette.
Yeah. What do you think about the gold and gold miners right now? Because everything that we're talking about with M2 and potential inflation, maybe stagflation, it just seems like gold should be going up. It's not. It's been going down for, I don't know, call it 6 months or something like that. Maybe the attention is more so focused on Bitcoin, but is that an opportunity to buy gold or maybe the gold miners at a cheaper price because no one's paying attention?
Well, let's put things into context. Last year, silver was up 42%, I think. Gold was up about 25 or 26%. And they peaked in August. Last year, we saw obviously a very sharp drop in real rates, a sharp decline in the dollar. And then the dollar started to flatten out. And I think this recent pullback is because the dollar has bounced and real rates have inflected up. But you look at five-year real rates, they're barely off the bottom. 10-year, a little more so because they're less tied to what the Fed is doing in the short end. But if you believe, as I do, big picture, that the dollar is going to be challenged by these rising U.S. debts and deficits, then that is going to be bullish for gold and silver. Silver has the benefit of being half the demand being industrial. Mm-hmm. And as the economy rebounds and you know, they're also a sort of a new age raw material, particularly in electric vehicles and solar panels, silver, that they'll get an investment lift from that. And if you believe, like I do, that inflation is going to pick up further from here, that I think that real rates, notwithstanding this little move higher, will head back down again and go much lower, because I believe that the Fed will way overstay its welcome with its easing. They will be very slow, if ever, to raise short-term interest rates. And then at least at the five-year, real rates are going to get even more negative. And if you do get the Fed trying to fight the market or even through yield curve control, then you'll get even deeper negative real interest rates, which will be positive for gold and silver. So while it hasn't been fun owning it, I think that investors should own it. I think the whole conversation with Bitcoin is complete nonsense. And a lot of people that love Bitcoin, and I respect them because I respect the whole thesis behind it, to think that it's one or the other is nonsense. Right. It's not buy Amazon or Google. You can buy them both. You can buy steak and chicken. You don't just one, that they can both go up because the thesis for both are still the same. And Bitcoin that's 12 years old is not replacing something that's 5,000 years old. It's just not happening. And while a 25-year-old may think that because Bitcoin is the new cool thing, and again, I think Bitcoin is there's a lot to it and it's not going anywhere, to think that it has to replace gold, I think is nonsense. It can complement it, not replace it.
Well, Peter, have fun staying poor. And for those of you who are not on Twitter, that's a very famous saying that the Bitcoiners, whenever you say anything that that's counter to their belief system, that's what they follow up with, is have fun staying poor.
It's not named Bitcoin. I get it. I'm full, but I hear what you're saying, because there are gold bulls that are anti-Bitcoin. I'm a gold bull that, while I'm not necessarily bullish Bitcoin, I respect it, I acknowledge it, and I let it, it's going to do its thing.
Yeah. All right, Peter. Well, I really appreciate your time. Fantastic conversation, as always. For my viewers and listeners who want to find out more about what you do, where can they go?
So anybody interested in the wealth management side, you can go to bleakley.com and reach out to me. And if you're interested in reading my daily macro missives, you can go to bookreport.com. That's B-O-O-C-K, report.com, and they can trial the service. And if they like it, they can subscribe.
Awesome, Peter. Thank you very much. Can't wait to do it again.
Yeah, take care.
Thank you for listening to the Rebel Capitalist Show. For more content like this, check out the Rebel Capitalist blog at georgegammon.com. or go to the George Gammon YouTube channel.